Welcome to the Responsible Management Podcast from the School of Management at the University of Bradford. My name is David Spicer. I'm the school's Director of Business and Community Engagement, and I'm delighted to be able to host these podcasts for you. We've got a bit of a treat for the podcast today, a sort of one-to-one conversation, a break from our normal format, and I'm delighted to be joined by Joyce Kumba-Sewell, and we're going to be talking about understanding neurodiversity in the workplace. Joyce is a mentor and trainer. She's one of a small minority of mentors and trainers who are themselves autistic. She's got a BA in counselling, coaching and mentoring, an MSc in the history of autism, and she's currently undertaking a PhD on older women's experience of autism and their relationship with diagnosis. Joyce, thank you very much for joining us. So we'll start with responsible management, if that's okay, before we kind of get into talking about neurodiversity and the challenges and opportunities that come with that. But if you perhaps just tell us a bit about what does the term responsible management mean for you?
I think the thing is neurodiversity is such a wide word with so many meanings. But I do think management need to be responsible in the way that they deal with everybody's differences. And I mean everybody's. My hope is one day we won't need to talk about this subject because it will just be part of, you know, the whole world will accept this rather than it just being, oh, I've got to look out for these poor people, which is the attitude of today.
So in context, responsible management is very much therefore about recognising difference, diversity and celebrating that in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
So if we talk about neurodiversity today, could you just perhaps define that? You said it covers a multitude of areas. What does that mean?
If we break that down, all human beings have neurons in our brains, and they're all different from one person to another. So I'm autistic, so my brain is in a certain way. But my wife isn't autistic, but she's actually officially known as a genius, and her brain is wired, if you like, in a different way. But neurodiversity is not just about our brains. It can be also about physical disabilities or Down syndrome. It's like we also tend to talk about it as well, about people's skin colour or the accents they use. It seems such a huge word in today's world, which I think, as time goes on, will become a normal part of the world.
Yeah, so I mean, that was sort of what popped into my head as you were talking about where we might be on that journey in terms of, because I think I like to think we're much more aware of, you know, differences of perspective, people with different processing models, different ways of looking at the world than we were 5, 10, 20 years ago. What's your impression? Is that the case? Have I got gold-tinted spectacles or is there still some way to go?
If we look right the way back, so I'm going to rely on my masters at this point. So we go back to the 19th century. There was no word of autism. People were imbeciles and idiots and words like that that are not correct in today's society. By the 20th century, those words had changed. And now we're in the 21st century. And people do say to me, why do we have to have these labels? Let's not have these labels, but we need labels to educate people. And I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime because I'm quite old, but I hope that in time we won't need the labels because we won't need to define people by who they are. My argument is if everybody's kind, isn't that a better label? So I think we need the labels now. And we are moving, but it seems to be century by century by century. So I'm just hoping things get speeded up a little bit.
Okay, so in terms of that speeding up, in terms of building that awareness, what's the business case here? So if we're talking to a business audience, our kind of largely SME kind of listener body, why should they be looking to understand and embrace different perspectives in this regard?
Because if we put things in place from day one, they don't accumulate and probably end up in a big scenario and a big saga that then has to be fixed. So let me just give you one very small example. I was working with a business that had a young lady. She'd never told them she was autistic, because actually, if you put that on your CV, you're not liable to get a job. She did very well. This company did presentations, and she used to write the presentations. And then we hit COVID. and they wanted her to go onto Zoom and do the presentations on Zoom, and which she did, and she did them very well. But in the end, she went to personnel and she said, I can't do this anymore. I'm going home overnight. I'm completely stressed out. I'm having meltdowns. I just can't do it. And the company's reaction was, well, she'll have to go. And she didn't tell us she was autistic. So that's another good reason she'll have to go. And I went along and spoke to them. And I said, there's a very simple solution. Let her carry on writing the presentations because they're very good. Get somebody else to do the presentations. And in the meantime, instead of having her sat in the middle of this great big office full of people, either move her to a corner or a smaller office on her own. And they listened and they did all that and they're all perfectly happy and she's still working there. And it saved a lot of trouble and a lot of hoo-ha just by making a few adjustments.
So is that the key to this? Is this about recognising that people do things differently, that from a business perspective, we need to be making those kind of adjustments?
Yeah, but we need to make those adjustments from day one. And we need to have a society where it's okay to put on your CV, your diversities. I can give you lots of examples. A Down syndrome young man, actor, doing really well, getting quite well known. But people started saying that he was being forced to do this by his parents because, well, he's down, so he can't make decisions for himself. And this guy got really, really cross and he said, I might have Downs, but I can make my own decisions. I'm a great actor. I love what I'm doing. But people have presumptions, just like they do of autistic people or Downs people, or how many people in wheelchairs that people only talk to the person pushing the wheelchair, not the person in the wheelchair. So we're still at that stage. We still need to educate people.
It's about encouraging people to look past stereotypes, to yes. think about their own perceptual biases and their own kind of perceptual kind of processes in that regard. So who are the key stakeholders in this? I mean, obviously business leaders have a role to play, but who else can kind of help change this agenda?
Yes, business leaders. And if it's a bigger businesses, obviously we're talking about the management and personnel or even the supervisor or, you know, the foreman. It needs to go all the way down. But I also say, well, hang about. To get to that stage, these people have been through school and college. How many people in those schools and colleges have the training that they need to understand those people? And when I say, so let's look at a school. The Senko is probably trained. The TAs may be trained. Is the cleaner? Is the caretaker? Are the people doing the cooking and serving the meal? It's like it has to be a lot more diverse. It has to become the norm for all of this so that we all understand the different diversities.
So the school's a kind of great example, isn't it? Because if we're educating everybody in school, both teachers and students and everybody involved yep. in that ecosystem, people coming out of that environment will have much more open perspectives, presumably.
Those people, those children will become not just the workers, but they may become the foremans and the managers and the directors, or they may be like me and be self-employed. And if they have been brought up to this normalization, then generation by generation, it will just become normal and we will stop seeing all these diversities.
What about, I mean, phrasing myself carefully because I don't want to make a political statement.
I know.
But I wonder about, you know, about the NHS, it's not really an NHS issue, but the government agenda, are we as a, well, let's use the big word, are we as a state doing enough?
No. It's less than baby steps. There is more openness. And I hate to say this, but a lot comes down to money because training costs money. And there's still this thinking that the diverse people are the minority. No, that a lot of diverse people are hiding their diversity. So I'll give you another example. So I'm doing a PhD, as David said, I'm looking at why is it so hard for older women to be diagnosed with autism. Now, one of the reasons is masking. Masking just means that you hide who you are. So I'm going to give you a little example. You're down the pub or you're out with your friends. Somebody tells a joke. Everybody laughs, but you don't find it funny. I guarantee you'll laugh because you won't want to be thought of as odd, different, whatever. That's just masking. But with women, no offense here, David, women are supremely better at it than men. And so we're so used to hiding who we are that actually people don't realize that actually we're different. Or at best, they might think, oh, she's a little bit eccentric. So, you know, we've also got to encourage people to stop masking. So why can't you admit you didn't find the joke funny? Maybe someone would explain it to you. But we have all these social norms. And I often ask, who is this person called Social Norm who invents all these social norms?
Yeah, Norman Social.
And then Normal Social. Oh, yeah, I like that. Yeah, I'm going to keep that one.
We'll both be using that, I'm sure. I'm sure. That's really great. Thank you. I mean, we talked a little bit about firms and you mentioned, you know, the obviously layers of management and the dynamics of a larger firm. As a network, we're particularly focused on and we work a lot with SMEs. I just wonder about the challenges of size. Is this, I guess in my head, I'm thinking, well, if you're a big firm, it's easier to have systems and structures and policies and processes if they're the right thing. But go back to your earlier example, it's probably easier for a small firm to make local adjustments. So do you think, where's the sweet spot, I guess?
Okay, if you want to know where the sweet spot is, you find that a lot of neurodiverse people actually set up their own companies because it's actually easier to work for yourself than to work with other people. So back to my examples, I'm going to give you an example of myself. Now, years ago, quite a long time ago, I was a doctor's receptionist. Don't hold it against me, okay? And one day we were holding an antenatal clinic and I was working with a much younger receptionist and things weren't going particularly well and the doctor in charge called me into his office. He was really cross and he told me to go and sort the other receptionist out because she was messing up his appointment system. I thought that's what he wanted me to do. So I did exactly what he told me to do. She cried. She made a complaint. There was a meeting. The doctor denied what he'd said, or rather said what he thought he meant. And I got the sack. Okay. So we also have to realize that us autistic people, we're quite literal. We're quite black and white people. So there's, you know, I then started being self-employed and I've been self-employed, I would have said for a good 20 years. But if you do work for a company, if you've got, I mean, in my first self-employed job, I had staff and that was okay because I was the boss. And it's different if you're the boss rather than being somebody who just works for the boss. And it's about everybody. So it's not just about the management knowing, it's about everybody knowing. So why, you know, companies will often have group sessions that they'll send away for training. Why is everybody not being sent for neurodiversity training, whatever that might be?
Brilliant. Yeah, no, definitely. You've raised some interesting research questions in my head that the answers may be out there, but is there a higher prevalence of neurodiversity amongst entrepreneurs and as small business owners, is there a higher prevalence within people in self-employment? You know, yeah, those would be interesting questions to kind of answer if people are self-selecting or finding that that's a career or a route that kind of suits them better.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. They'll do that research after your PhD, maybe.
My next one.
do that for the next one. I'm just cutting into the podcast to tell you a little bit about the offer that we have for businesses locally as part of the business and community engagement support. We have our Knowledge Transfer Network, that's regular networking events where you can come on campus, meet like-minded people, hear from some of our and leading industry experts. We have our Bradford Business Challenge projects, where we have students coming out and working with you and supporting the work that you do. We have our consultancy clinic, where we have students delivering on short-term small projects for businesses as well. There's also lots of ways that you can engage with and interact with our students as guest lecturers, as mentors on some of our entrepreneurship programs and through involvement in the curriculum. And equally, from a research perspective, we can work with you on collaborative research. If you think there's something we can help with, please reach out to us at BACE, that's base BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. Thank you. And now back to the podcast. You mentioned COVID earlier in your example and how the experience of COVID had almost brought for that individual a new challenge. And I just wondered about that, those kind of challenges. So obviously, we're in the post-COVID environment now. I think we can safely say that. Still out there, but we're living with it. But that is having an impact on how people engage with each other. We've got the current financial crisis and the economic challenges that we're facing. So, you know, we're recording on the day that the Bank of England, you know, didn't raise the interest rates, but they haven't lowered them, you know, so we're still at 5.25%.
Okay, Frost Savers.
Yeah, well, still got a mortgage. So yeah, slightly on the other side of that one at the moment. But from that kind of perspective, you know, I just wonder how the environment plays into this. Because what we're talking about, I guess, are ideals. Yeah, and we're talking about training and developing and raising awareness. Do you think the current climate makes it harder to do those things?
I think the financial climate does, because everything is so expensive. Training courses are extortionate. But I think Zoom and Teams was the making of COVID and a lot of businesses. So before COVID, I'd never used either of those platforms. I knew about Zoom. I didn't know about Teams. But I work with a lot of, if I say, I'm loosely going to use the term disabled university students. I don't particularly like the word disabled, but the majority of them are on the autistic spectrum. Not only did they love Zoom, they've stayed on Zoom. They don't want to come off Zoom. We get new students every year. They want Zoom as well. It's rare for a student not to love Zoom. I went to my first face-to-face meeting last week, and it's funny. It's odd seeing people. You know, I think Zoom's great. And training courses. So I run two companies with my wife. So we've got Cumbersall Enterprises LLP, which is where we work with a lot of students and do. My wife is a word nerd, so she does a lot of proofreading, words-based things. I'm mentoring and I'm a public speaker. And then over the summer, we decided to launch a CIC, so Cumbersall Training CIC, and we're running training courses, but we're doing them online. And the reason we're doing them online is twofold. People who want to come on our courses are all over the country. And if they're on Zoom, they don't have to meet up. They don't have to spend out that transport and accommodation and everything else. They can just do it from the comfort of their own homes. We're doing it on a Saturday so that people don't have to take a day off work. And I think there is a potential for more training to be done at less price. This is not about making profit. This is about training. And I think sometimes the people in charge miss that and they just see it as another way of making money. And that's not what training is designed for.
Great. Now, I was about to come on and ask about what you and your organisation do in terms of promoting and...
Sorry, David.
No, it's great. It's great because you got that, and it's really good to hear, because there's clearly a demand and a kind of a need for that kind of out there. How do we convince the skeptics? How do we, you know, get the people that are going, oh, well, yeah, but, you know, to take this seriously?
I have people who don't know me particularly well. And so I'm very out and proud, okay? So I will tell everybody that I'm autistic. And please, please, I beg you, people, do not respond with, but you don't look autistic. Or the other bad one is, well, everybody's a little bit autistic. Please don't do that. But I now have an answer. So what I say to people is go on to the National Autistic Society's website. They have a question sheet and you can tick boxes on there if, you know, everybody, and I mean everybody, can tick 2, 3, 4 boxes. But to be autistic, you've got to tick the majority. To which people normally respond with, see, I told you everybody's a little bit autistic. And I say, okay, now I want you to go on the Down syndrome website, because I guarantee you can tick 3 or 4 of their boxes too. That's the point. It all gets a bit impolite, so I won't go any further with that. But we're all human beings. And I'm just going to give another example. Do shut me up if I'm going on too much, David. Okay. But My wife, us as a family, actually, we all decided to do the online Mensa test. Now, to be a member of Mensa, your IQ's got to be in the top 2% of the world. And from there, we went and we sat the actual exam. I'm only on the 15th percentile, which, you know, is good. It's good. My wife is in the top 1% of the world. And officially, and I mean officially, not just by Mensa terms, officially she's known as a genius. When she got that, may I say, diagnosis, she had a very similar reaction to other people getting maybe an autism diagnosis. She suddenly realized how she had hidden herself all her life because actually people don't accept that she's a genius, that she's so intelligent. They've called her big-headed and arrogant and all sorts of things. And I've got to admit, sometimes when we're talking, I just stop and let her finish the sentence. And then I have to ask her to say it in English because she likes to use those long academic words that I don't particularly understand. But we all have differences and they all have impacts on our life. And we have to just accept that. You know, my wife's no different now than she was before she got her diagnosis. She's the same person, but now she doesn't hide it.
Great. So if somebody's been listening today and they're going, okay, so I need to go away. I need to do something about this. I need to go back and think about our responsibilities in respect of neurodiversity. Where can they start? What's the practical advice, the kind of the small wins that a business can take in this regard?
Okay. So I would say in the majority of businesses, no matter what the size, obviously more so the bigger they are, they will have neurodiverse people. So don't go to those people first. Educate yourself and then do training that everybody does. So it's not just the management does it. It's not just the foreman and the people like that. It's everybody. So it is the cleaner and the cook, as well as every single person who works there does this training. And there's loads of training out there. I'm not plugging my own training, though, of course I am. There's lots and lots of training, and not just in autism, in all sorts of things. And maybe, and I don't do this, but I've just had a thought, we should actually do training in accepting people's differences. So it doesn't matter what country somebody's come from. It doesn't matter if they're in a wheelchair. A young girl went to university and got her degree, a good degree, and she started applying for jobs. And she'd get to that stage where they'd meet her and she'd have the physical interview, and then she would be told, we'd really like you to offer you the job, but our building cannot accommodate your wheelchair. And this happened time and time again. And she went for her 20th face-to-face interview. And the guy said, really like to give you the job, but we don't have lifts in our building and you would need to be on the third floor. So what we're going to do, we're going to move the third floor office to the ground floor and the ground floor office to the third floor. And please, will you start on Monday? That's how small a change they had to make. And we need to be looking at all people, accepting all people, because...
Really, that's really great, Joyce. Our final question for all of our contributors is a bit of a shift of tone.
Okay.
And we've asked this of everybody who's been involved in the series. And it's about your... Well, I phrase it your management hero. So we're a school of management. So... Yeah, the person, from a personal or professional perspective, who's inspired or influenced you the most in the career. We don't necessarily need to know the name, but and it might be something you read, it might be something you worked with.
Yes, actually. Do you know, I was looking at this earlier and I was thinking, oh, there isn't anybody. But actually, there is an organisation and I'm still going back quite a long time, and they talk about your past is in your past. The future hasn't happened. You can only live in the moment. And I think that had a huge impact on me, that I can't live in what's already been and gone. I don't know what's coming in the next 2 seconds, right now, right this second. And I think that that organisation, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say who they are. Yeah, okay, so it's Landmark Education. They operate in about 55 countries throughout the world. I did it in London, and it's called the Landmark Forum. You can find it online, and absolutely phenomenal. And I learned a lot more through that organisation than anything else.
Brilliant, Joyce. Thank you very, very much indeed. I found it really, really interesting, really, really stimulating. If people want to reach out to you, what's the best way to contact you?
They can go to my website, which is www.autism.coombersall.co.uk. I am on LinkedIn, if you just put my name in. There are only two Coombersalls in the world. So if you put Coombersall as one word, it was originally two words. My wife's surname was Coomber and my name was Sewell, and we put it together and we are the only two in the world.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. So, of course, if you want to reach out to us here at the School of Management, you can find us on the web. If you want to contact me via social media, I'm at Dave P. Spicer, or the school is at Brad Management. If you want to email us, it's BACE, Base Business and Community Engagement, BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. If you've enjoyed the podcast, we'd love you to like and subscribe. Five-star reviews are much preferred, of course, as well. Thank you very much, Joyce, and join us again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
If you've got a project that you'd love to get done, but you're struggling with the time and resources to do that, that's something that we can help you with. Bradford Business Challenge projects are where we get our students to do, as part of their dissertation, a piece of applied management work for a business like yourself. Either one of our final year undergraduate or MSc students, with the support of an academic mentor, will be able to work on that project for you. There's no cost for you as a business. All we ask for you is to set up with us that project, give us a kind of outline brief that the student will go away and work into a full proposal for you, and then you'll be meeting and liaising with them and their academic advisor to get that project delivered. Because we have multiple students doing these over the course of the year, there's usually a group of students looking for any project at one time. So if that's something that you're interested in and you'd like to know more about, please reach out to us at BACE, base at bradford.ac.uk.